Good morning, everyone. My name is Ian Rabb, and I'm an alcoholic.
Wow.
I'm completely overwhelmed. First of all, the room's full. I came here and thought, this room will never fill up. And as I was walking around yesterday and looking at the bigger rooms, I thought, I hope I'm not in that room. So here I am. And what a privilege it is to be asked to share today, and an incredible topic of tolerance and trust. I'm not a speaker that usually writes notes, and I was speaking with my sponsor, and he said, when you speak at an international conference, you write your talk. So bear with me, because I don't usually do that. So, as I was first reflecting upon my experience with these two words separately and together as a phrase, lots of thoughts flooded my mind, going back to my early recovery and obviously until now. These are clearly two spiritual principles that, along with many others, I need to maintain daily to live happy, joyous, and free. Trust God, clean house, help others, my sponsor stated over and over. These early words of my mean old sponsor telling me over and over and over, he'd say, you don't have a problem, you are the goddamn problem. Which made me think that tolerance is all he had. But it's really funny because, truthfully, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, it took every fiber of my being to tolerate and put up with all of you, let alone trust the word that you were saying or asking me to do. I just knew that I was down for the count and had no choice but to do everything this program and my sponsor had asked of me. As I remained sober and continued doing these steps and doing my very best to live by these principles, on some level, I believe that this principle of tolerance was one that I spent lots of time practicing on all of you. I recall a conversation with my sponsor sharing with him that I'd become so tolerant of my fellows, so tolerant of my staff, incredibly tolerant of my family, that being involved in service at the area level basically rocketed me into an awesome, loving, tolerant guy. He looked at me and laughed and said, have you ever heard of the phrase principles before personalities? And I said, of course. He said, first of all, it's so noble of you to have become that way. His sarcasm was so deadly. But more importantly, it's before your personality, he said. And you are, and we are just tolerating you. And oh boy, what a lesson I learned. In the Alcoholics Anonymous book, as Bill sees it, there's a quote on page 312 taken from a letter written by one of our co-founders, Bill W., in 1943. The title of the writing is Tolerance Keeps Us Sober. And it reads, honesty with ourselves and others get us sober, but it's tolerance that keeps us that way. Tolerance keeps us sober. I can only imagine what Bill was thinking back in 1943 and the meaning of this statement today to my own sobriety and to the fellowship that has survived 80 years. The concerns back then, so different than the concerns of today, but really in principle, totally the same. What would become of this organization if we had allowed diversity and adversity to rule? I know I would have been dead. I was one of those strange alcoholics, and when I got here, and through the traditions, we survived, and so have I. A clear message was sent to all the members, people in recovery, and to me today, that for Alcoholics Anonymous to prosper, the foundation needed for this long-term survival stood in learning to accept all of our differences. We are normally people who would not mix. And this is done by me living and practicing tolerance, and thankfully, AA and all of you have done the same regarding me, allowing me to continue growing up and making mistakes. In 1944, Dr. Bob also wrote on this very topic called Cultivating Tolerance. He stated, those who follow the AA program with the greatest earnestness and zeal not only maintain sobriety, but often acquire finer characteristics and attitudes as well, and one of those is tolerance. So clearly, both of our co-founders, early in AA's history, have felt that fostering this needed principle has a great benefit. And so as I reflected again on my time here in AA, this needed ideal has set me free time and time again. It gives me the patience for those just starting out. It has time and time again removed from me the contempt and the prejudice which blocks me from my fellows, this program, life, and most importantly, God. I have become more kind. I have learned to love unconditionally, allowing each their own path. It allows me to be considerate of those that have different, that are different than I am, because it's very easy in AA to start believing that my way is the best and only way. And most importantly, the freedom that comes from the steps will disappear without any degree of this principle. On page 92 of the 12 Steps and 12 Traditions, Bill writes, "Finally, we begin to see that all people, including ourselves, are to somewhat extent emotionally ill, as well as frequently wrong. When this happens, we approach true tolerance and we see what real love for our fellow really means. As I've traveled this path and walked towards emotional sobriety, I must fully commit to an entire psychic change. My sponsor used to say, complete and utter abnegation of self. But how? How can that happen? What actions do I need to take?" You had to see me writing this. I was in front of my computer talking to it, and people in my office often looked in and kind of like, what's going on in there? When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was a broken man, or better yet, a broken child. I grew up in a non-alcoholic home, but a home where pressure to succeed in life was completely overwhelming, perceived or real. I had a brother and sister that were highly successful and much older, and my interpretation was that I was nothing if I was not the same or followed the same path. My mom used to read us books. My brother was read a book, How to Become a Lawyer, and he became a lawyer. I was read a book, How to Become a Doctor, and I became a doctor. And my sister was read a book, How to Marry a Doctor, and she married a doctor. Actually, she was the smartest of all of us. Literally, not only the doctor. But I learned tolerance right about then. Nothing but the best was expected from us. My value system was created from my interpretations of the lies that I had told myself. They engulfed my every thought till I was broken down enough to let principles that I have practiced here come to life. You see, I believe the tolerance that Bill and Bob are speaking of so freely in AA, the tolerance necessary for that psychic change to occur, is about a completely new way of living. I had to learn how to become a human being, not a human doing, with a completely different set of values and principles directed from this book, from this, the big book, which I forgot this morning, from the steps, from service, from sponsorship. What an incredible gift. It's not about putting up with stuff or tolerating people, places, or things, then moving on to the next thing. It's about a completely different attitude, a new set of actions. I needed to learn that true unconditional love meant I needed to view each of our differences with that pure lens. The surrender that occurred in my life from the day I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, and then again every other single day when I wake up, has taught me this. Love and tolerance is our code. This only came through the incredible 12 steps and the transformation of thought and attitude that paralleled my spiritual experience and awakening. I just want to relate a couple stories that occurred in the last number of years where both tolerance and ultimately trust played a vital role. Clearly, as I grew up in Alcoholics Anonymous, my perception and understanding of these events change. I'm about to talk about someone and I get choked up. There was a woman at our group for many years. I would have called her a bleeding deacon when I got here. No matter what anybody said in our business meeting, she would give a contrary view. You know that type. She was in everyone's business when it came to the traditions of AA. One of those AA police that were going to keep us all straight and set us straight at every possible opportunity. For years and years, I tolerated what I considered to be her know-it-all, pay-attention-to-me behavior. On a few occasions, we had it out, raising our voices. You see, I couldn't tolerate her anymore. As I grew up in recovery and kept practicing these principles, I realized we and I needed people like her. She was actually a wealth of information. When I started to listen to what she actually had to say, everything changed. Whether I felt it was right or wrong, too little or too much, really started mattering less and less. I learned from my sponsor a critical thing many times over and over the years. Firstly, as we begin to share with each other, something changes in my relationships. From sharing comes caring, and from caring comes the unconditional love, and ultimately, the trust needed to foster right actions, right thinking, and most importantly, right reactions. This woman who I grew to love and care about more became an important role and model in my AA life and in my AA service life. Her criticism changed to thoughtful suggestions, and we began to see eye to eye. And in the AA spirit, could easily agree or disagree, carrying out the conscience of our group, the group conscience. She's no longer with us. She's at the big meeting in the sky, and she's greatly missed by me and many other of her old opponents. No, just kidding. Gail kept me right-sized. Right or wrong didn't matter. Tolerance prevailed and turned into trust. It was no longer about her or I. As we know, I have come to learn alcoholism or the recovery from alcoholism firstly takes deflation of ego at depth. To this day, I'm not sure what comes first, tolerance or the necessary ego deflation. My old sponsor would say all the time, it's a divine impossibility to satisfy the human ego, and that the ego of the alcoholic was obsessed with itself. I completely got that. I was not tolerant of anything or anybody. It was my way or the highway. I did what I wanted, when I wanted, with no regard for anyone else. It wasn't until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous that I understood my real problem. The problem that crippled me since childhood. The feeling of conscious separation, of being disconnected from life, from everything good, from love, from God, from my family, from everybody and everything. But most importantly, lacking these so important principles, I remember saying to Tom, my sponsor, that I don't trust anyone or anything, that I knew that everyone was out to get me, and that this life was completely unfair to me. His only response was, I guess that you're untrustworthy. That hurt so bad, because I believed myself to be a man of integrity and valor. Then he reminded me of my 7 arrests, and then I almost ended up in jail. For 68 years. Thank God for AA and all of you. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous provided me a way of deflating that ego. I very slowly started to get rid of that obsession with self, temporarily and later, as I continued to practice our program of recovery, unity, and service. The measure of that freedom from the obsession with self for the obsessed ego enlarged. Ego deflated, I could finally see how contempt, prejudice, and intolerance kept me away from every relationship in my life. What never ceases to amaze me is that these walls are broken down, and I see the process working as my actions and thinking changes as a result of the work and continued actions in our legacies. I begin to trust slowly. First, I trust my sponsor, then my group, then the book, then the steps, and then I realize that the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous is not that I don't drink anymore, but clearly that my relationships have changed, and I must practice these principles daily in my affairs for that to maintain. I want to relate one more story where I felt that these intertwined principles worked in my life, teaching me a great lesson. Tom used to say, something happens and there's a lesson. And then something else happens and there's a lesson. Then the lesson, as you'd better pay attention to those damn lessons. So I did. Carrying the message is the basic service that the fellowship gives. Our third legacy of service must be treasured. How I treasure that gift is to pass along to those behind me the most meaningful example of service that I can provide. That comes with scrutiny and errors. I recall not long ago in service, I was provided with one of the greatest lessons. I'm provided many incredible lessons from this gift as I'm conscious to them. I was the chair of Area 80, Manitoba, Canada. I recently had attended one of other assemblies in our region and back with knowledge of exactly what our area needed to sponsor, to prosper and grow. I was immediately to implement all of these new incredible ideas. Much to my dismay, the plan didn't go off as I had planned. And of course, I was hurt. How could these other service alkies not see the benefit as I did? I recalled reading from the service manual written by Bill on leadership, and he suggested that once assured that it has or can be obtained sufficient general backing, it freely takes decisions and puts them into action forthwith, provided, of course, that such actions be within the framework of its defined authority and responsibility. Although great ideas and thoughts, without the support of those I serve or serve with me, I had no business trying to implement or impress what I thought on my fellows. And boy, did I get the message loud and clear. What a gift that all of you provided me. The grace to learn the lessons and use it in all of my affairs and everywhere in my life. A true gift of service. Here are some perfect gifts given to me by the power through the efficacy of a program of action, the love of the fellowship, and the sacrifice of our service, our third legacy. So what does this all have to do with trust and tolerance, you're asking me? As personalities prevailed and took over, mine and others, feelings were hurt, including mine. All of us forgot to trust in our power and the conscience of the group. People started getting mean and creating teams. There was no tolerance for growth and mistakes. I decided to trust in these principles, trust in the program, trust in God, and I refused to get involved in the personality game, or defending any of my actions. As everyone scurried about the room with their AA opinions, I just sat back, practiced the principle of anonymity, and trusted the process, and we all survived. Bill said it best, only mutual trust can be the foundation of great love, each of us for other, and all of us for God. So, my friends, I need to do many things and continue to take certain actions for these principles to remain clear in my mind. I must drop prejudicial negative thinking, and my actions needed to be grounded in these steps to create necessary surrender needed to practice tolerance. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. My path, my journey, must be of tolerance and trust. This challenges my beliefs, my patterns, and my way of thinking, and it allows me to live and let live. Now when I hear Tom's voice in my head stating over and over, trust God, clean house, help others, all I think about is how lucky I am to have found the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And thank you for my life.
Thank you, Ian. Ellen, please. Oh, my gosh.
Hi, my name's Ellen, and I'm an alcoholic. I am from Area 21 in the East Central Region. I want to thank Becky for the opportunity to speak here today. I'm from District 19, and I would be a lot more nervous than I am, except you wonderful people have taught me that this doesn't have a damn thing to do with me. It's all about what our collective higher power, it's not even what I'm going to say, it's about what your higher power is going to have you here. And the really cool thing about it is that's not even about you, it's about what you might tell somebody today, and it might not have anything to do with what I say, it's just about what we're supposed to be passing on. So that really takes the pressure off. Also, for the record, I dress nice, not because it's important what you think of me, but because I am representing you here. And I took the MART up this morning, so I wore comfy shoes. My dress shoes are in my purse on the floor there by my husband, if anybody wants to see them later. I brought them. When I got the email and I was asked to speak on this panel, I started thinking about trust and tolerance. And what I can tell you about my experience is that when I came here, this is so funny to me, I had a hard time with trust. You know how you sit in meetings and newcomers say they have trust issues and it's like they're the only one that ever had a trust issue? I remember when I thought I was all unique about that. And yet I honestly believe my higher power struck me trusting in my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I walked in, and when you people said you were sober, I believed you. And when you said you were having happy, joyous, free lives, I believed you. And when you said it was possible for other people to do that, I believed you. And that's not how I worked. I had stopped trusting people at a very early age. And I had a long, sad story to explain that to anybody that would sit or stand still and listen. about how people had let me down. Again, very unique, because the rest of you came here and you'd never been let down by anybody, but boy, if you had my story, and looking back, what I realize, and I believe Ian mentioned it, is I became a very accomplished liar at a very early age, really early. And since I was the person that I had the most experience with, and I knew myself to be inherently untrustworthy, it makes sense to me that that I pretty much thought everybody else was. So I came in, and I trusted what I was hearing. However, and I'm sure people can relate to this, when I got here, the only thing I was doing was not drinking. I brought every bit of my barroom behavior into AA. I brought my language in. I brought my attire in. I brought my attitude toward both genders in. I brought my, oh, yeah, you want to fill in the blank attitude. And you folks started teaching me about tolerance the very first meeting, because nobody said, you know, Ellen, what would really be helpful is if you went home and you found a skirt that covered more of you than that one does, and you found words to explain things that weren't offensive to most of the people in the room, and you didn't become quite so focused on your own little story, and you weren't so angry. The two things I didn't bring in here is I wasn't drinking and I wasn't physically violent. However, a longtime member of our fellowship told me that for quite a while after I got here, if I sat next to him in a meeting, he'd say he was going to get coffee and he'd move across the room because I was just looking for a fight. Nobody told me that. You know what people told me? You know what people told me. They said, keep coming back. And I understand today why. Because you know what? The steps will help with that. The steps will help with whatever that is. The steps will help with that. So I came, and there was that power of the shared experience in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I felt that. And then the next thing that happened was you folks gave me permission to be honest, and then you tolerated me when I was. I can't thank you enough for that, because I was honest all over everybody all the time. Because I was not yet working the steps. However, that was crucial. That was crucial in my step to freedom from the physical craving and the mental obsession for alcohol. And I thank you for it. And you tolerated me. And then there was the program. You know, after a while, I kind of started getting the inkling it wasn't just about all you amazing people and the smiles and the coffee and that I could tell you anything. And, you know, most of you didn't run screaming out of the room. There was this program. There were these 12 steps and 12 traditions, and it was outlined in our text, Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was one of those people, and again, I trust there are folks here, that I was going to get that information, and I was going to take it home, and I was going to inflict sobriety on myself. And every day I would come back and report, you know, frequently I'd come back and report my progress, and I would also try and inflict that on whatever, you know, people were around me, because I had all this information. I wasn't practicing it, but I'd accumulated a lot of information. And God bless you, you tolerated that. I mean, at every step of my process, I was still just a mess, because we are, you know, not because I was some kind of grandiose mess or a bigger mess or a different mess. We wouldn't come here if we weren't. And you folks tolerated and tolerated and tolerated. And then when I got finally, gratefully, thankfully, to that understanding that I was not only going to need to really work the steps, I was going to need help doing it, the way that people responded to that, you know, I don't think anybody said to me, it's about time. I'm sure people were thinking it. Because I was one of those people that was going to figure, I was raised by two CPAs, so give me a checklist and stand back. I believe I've computed within a 5-point margin of error how many people are in this room right now, because that's what I do in my free time. So nobody said, you know, thank God, it's about time. They just said, yeah. Yeah, we'll help you, because that's what we do. And that ego deflation that Ian talked about was so vitally necessary for me as I believe it is for all of us. However, I did not go quietly into the ego deflation night, and You know, I would call people up and be surprised that I discovered new character defects, because when I first came in, my problem was drinking, and I wasn't drinking, so yay, you know, all done with all that. And then as you go through the steps, if I'm doing it under the direction of a sponsor that's done it under the direction of a sponsor that's doing it out of our text, there's a lot more information there about a lot of things that I need a lot of help with, both from my sponsor and primarily from my higher power, because that's where the change is going to take place. It embarrasses me to say, I used to say, you know, I'm here because you people have given me the power to change me. I can't change me. If I could change me, I wouldn't be standing up here. I wouldn't be an AA. You know, I'd get up one morning and go, abracadabra, or change. I can't think my way out of alcoholism, out of my character defects, into right living. And that is some of the most valuable information this alcoholic has today. So you folks tolerated me and continue to at every step of my program. I have a wonderful sponsor. She's here today, and she tells me direct things that I do not want to hear. I called her up a few months ago because I was having a situation in AA, and I was just sure I needed to say something to somebody. And thank goodness I've learned that maybe it's a good idea to check that with another person before I do. And she could have gone into a long, lengthy thing about that. What she said to me is, she said, Ellen, the only people who've asked for your opinion are the people that you sponsor. And I was like, really? Only them? Because I have so many opinions, and it just seems like that's not enough people to share them with. My husband refers to me as an opinion-rich environment. So you would think that based on all the tolerance that's been shown me for all the parts of my process, for all the years, that I would be immediately imbued with and just completely turn that around and you know, want to share that with other people. And when I saw the topic for this, I told my husband, I said, this is going to be interesting because I need to learn about tolerance. I have a lot of progress to make on that. I am an opinion-rich environment, and people come into AA, and you know what I think? I think they need to dress right. They need to act right. They need to clean up their language. They need not to be so angry. And thank God there are people in my town that were sober when I got sober, and they can remind me. When I talk in meetings about how I was, they nod their heads and they go, yeah, yeah, she was a pain, let me tell you. I need to remember that I got to have my process with alcohol long enough to get me here. The book says alcohol is a great persuader, and then I got to have my process with recovery long enough to discover some of the miracles that are available to me here, and that whether it's my natural inclination or not, I need to share that with other people. One of the other amazing things about trust for me is trusting the process, because again, I was raised by two CPAs, so I want concrete results, I want a checklist, and then I want backup documentation, you know? So thank God there's a book. I mean, really, thank God there's a book, and it's been around for 80 years, because somebody can say, look, it's in the book, it's been here for 80 years, calm down. Little by little, by working the steps and continuing to do so, again, under the direction of sponsors who have done the same, I have learned, first of all, this was a really big revelation to me, that I don't have to like the process to trust it. I was always willing to trust the parts of the process that were all warm and fuzzy and going my way. And however, guess what? They don't all do that. And I don't have to like it to trust it. And I don't have to be able to see those immediate results, whether it's working with another alcoholic. You know, it's great working with another alcoholic when they're like on fire and they're carrying their big book around and they're thumping other people with it. You know, but what about when they stop calling? What about when things change? And I have to remember again, it's not about me. The results are between them and their higher power. I am only the messenger. And I have had some vivid reminders lately of how important it is for me to trust the process and do what's in front of me in the meantime. Because, again, I want those quick results. You know, so I'll trust the process, and then 5 minutes later, I'm like, how's that process going? How's that coming along? Got any updates for me? I hit my bottom in Atlanta, Georgia, 30 years ago, this summer, and I have not been back to Atlanta since that time. And when I got the invitation to speak, it was in Atlanta, Georgia. And I was like, holy cow, I must be supposed to go back to Atlanta, Georgia. Isn't that interesting? When I left Georgia, I had an alcohol problem. I had two small children. I had very little belongings, and the airline lost a lot of them. So when I started over, I had even fewer. And everything I have today, most importantly internally and also externally, is a result of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of the things I loved is when I moved down to Atlanta, I had a job at the airport, at Hartsfield International Airport, and I loved working at the airport. I loved the lights, and I loved the planes. And I lost that job, not because of drinking, but because of insubordination, which really worked out well, because I would have lost it for drinking. So I just got out ahead of the curve. I think some of you will probably relate to this. I borrowed my boss's car one day, and the next day he called me into his office, and he said, "You're not going to believe this, but I found a half-consumed open bottle of whiskey in my car." And I said, "Thank God, I've been looking all over for that." That's how alcoholics think. Thank God. I know where the other half of that bottle of whiskey was. I need that. Not a surprise that I lost that job. And there's a dear friend of ours here that lives on the East Coast, and he came to the conference, and he's staying at a hotel that if it was any closer to the airport, it would be on the runway. And we had dinner there last night, and I got to watch those planes going up and down the runway as it got dark. And it was so nice just to have that reminder of one of the things that I loved about being here. Part of my story is that, as I mentioned, I have two daughters. I married a gentleman that was a musician. I met him in a bar. He was playing live music, and I'm a huge fan of live music. I believe there's such a spiritual component to that. On the break, the first night we met, he offered to buy me a drink. He proposed to me less than 10 minutes later. Because alcoholics know how to form permanent and lasting relationships. And that didn't work out so well. He was a musician, he was a drug user, he was a drug dealer, and he came to me one day and said, "Ellen, you've got to stop. You've got to stop." Now, most people would think this may be an important warning here. I did not think that. After our divorce, I was very worried for quite a while that he would try and get custody of our children, because he sure had the ammunition to do that. And we went through some contentious times. I got sober after our divorce, and he initially was very resistant to this whole AA thing. You know, you all know about the doubts people have about that. And through a series of processes and events that I get no credit for, he and his wife are dear friends of my husband and I today. And the last place we were before we came here for this conference was their house, 45 miles south of here. We spent 2 nights and 3 days with them. And the last thing I heard the last night we were there as I was falling asleep was him playing his guitar. So I don't ever know what the process is going to restore to me. All I got to do is keep doing what I have to do. And it may not be, you know, the way I think it's going to be, but it's going to be exactly and precisely the way it's supposed to be. Every single time. Every single time. And sometimes I remember that when I'm in something. Sometimes when something comes up, I can say, "It's going to be interesting to see what I'm going to learn from this." And sometimes when something comes up, I immediately turn into the AA police and form a committee. And, you know, I call it pitchforks to the castle, you know? God, I can get on a roll. But one of the other blessings, gifts, miracles is there are people around me that can say, "Ellen, do you remember when both your daughters started college in September and you lost your job in October? Do you remember when your house was foreclosed on? Do you remember when your first sponsor died after battling lung cancer? Do you remember when, you know, one or both of your daughters weren't speaking to you? Do you remember when your daughter showed up on Mother's Day and listed your sins in front of all the other guests?" We just spent a week with her, by the way, and it's lovely. I need to be reminded of how powerful my higher power is and of how not powerful I am so that I can continue to trust that. And I always, always, always need to be reminded of the tolerance you folks showed, because I would not have the life I had if anybody had said to me, "You can't come back." Now, there was one dear male friend of mine that finally sat me down and said, "Ellen, you can't wear that skirt to AA meetings anymore." And I'm grateful to him because I think he was acting in the group's best interest, not just my own. And I think it's important to be able to hear those things, the things that we need to hear. My longtime sponsor telling me, Ellen, you need to grow up. I sobbed. I was in my 30s, but growing up wasn't part of my plan. I just didn't want to die drunk, you know. Oh, my gosh. I'm going to tell you one more quick story about my sponsor because this is one of my favorites. I had the privilege of mentoring a young lady in Big Brother, Big Sister, and she is actually going to turn 21 the week after this conference. We're going to get to see her and celebrate with her sometime that week. And her family moved a lot, and she had to change schools a lot. I started mentoring her when she was in, like, third or fourth grade, and I was with her all through grade school, middle school, high school. And at least every year, she'd change schools. And I called my sponsor one day, and I was really choked up, and I said, oh, my gosh, her family moved, and she's going to have to change schools again. And my sponsor said, Ellen, if she wasn't from a troubled family, she wouldn't be in your life. I have to trust the direction I ask for. And I trust that. I trust that in my sponsor and the other people in my life because I know my sponsor has my best interests at heart. She's not infallible because guess what? She's human. But I know she works these steps to the best of her ability, and I know she doesn't want to hurt me. And so when she asks me to do something, I do it. You know why? Because my best idea got me here. Because before I got here, my best idea was to drink myself to death. And after I got here, when I was doing the really unlovely, I'm just going to not drink but not ask for help part of the program, my best idea was to white knuckle it as long as possible because I had two little girls and then kill myself because I was committed to not drinking, but I sure didn't know how I was going to live without a drink. And you folks changed all that. And I can't ever thank you enough. But the thing is, I know it's not about me thanking the people that gave it to me. You know, there's a guy in Springfield, one of my good friends asked him to sponsor him, and he said he'd do it. And my friend was like, thanks. And he said, I'm not doing it for you. I'm doing it for the people you're going to help. So they're not doing it for me. They're doing it for the people I'm going to help, and they're doing it for the people they're going to help. And that's why we're here 80 years later. I want to thank Dorothy for chairing our panel, for Ian for the great reminder about group conscience at the service level, and all of you for being part of all of our process. Thank you.
Thank you, Ellen. And our next presenter is on the program. It says Harry, but he says his name is Bub. So here's Bub.
Hi, I'm Bub, an alcoholic. My name itself is a testimony to how untrustful I was when I got here. I've been called Harry all my life except by my family, and I got to A, and they said, what's your name? I didn't want y'all to know who I was, so I said, my name's Bub, and it stuck. I got hundreds of people calling me by childhood nickname, but what an honor it is to be here. I was asked to do this in Montreal and was unable, and so God gives me a second chance. I appreciate all of you being here. Is anybody from Mississippi? Well, see, at my home group, they asked me, what are you going to talk about? I said, I'm going to talk about y'all. And so they all said they were coming. I just wanted to know if they got here. I asked myself, what do these two topics have to do with each other? And tolerance. Tolerance, you know, I think it's basically fear. Our literature says fear that we're going to lose something that we already have or not going to get something we demand. And fear is absence of trust in God. And that's what I came up with. And a lot's been said about tolerance and a good bit about trust. Ian, that was a brilliant speech. And Ellen, thank you for that. It was funny. You're a very funny person. I enjoyed that. Thank you. And so there's not much left for me to do, I don't guess. Good thing I wrote some things down. Well, here's a good one talking about tolerance. There's a sign in my church office that says, comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. Now, I got some people who really think I must look comfortable. They just... love to jab at me, you know. In fact, the first person I saw here that I knew threw an insult at me, and that's a bad idea to insult someone who's going to take the microphone. I was up half the night thinking about what I was going to say about her. My wife said, "That's a bad idea. Don't do that." There is I did research somewhat, reading on Google. I love Google, and finally got back to AA literature. Bill Wilson has this great thing, and as Bill says at page 28, troublemakers can be teachers. I got some great teachers. And he talks about, troublesome people. It says, we have begun to regard the troublesome ones not as a menace, but rather as our teachers. They oblige us to cultivate patience, tolerance, and humility. We finally see that they are only people sicker than the rest of us. You get that? That we who condemn them are the Pharisees whose false righteousness does our group the deeper spiritual damage. Wow. I mean, that nailed me good because that's my M.O. Talk about them behind their back, and all that stuff. And let's get something fight going, Thank goodness, my sobriety kicks in every now and then. And I don't have to join the fight, We're not fighting anyone or anything. Little factions and cliques in AA, and it's just so easy to get involved. I was in general service for 14 years at the area level, and I'm back down there again as a DCM. That's how we grow. You grow or you go, and AA is full of opportunities for that. I got sober in 1985 and sober 30 years this year, I would much rather talk about what 30 years of trust in God has done in my life to you, because it's some fantastic things. My life is way beyond anything I could have imagined or even thought to ask for. One idea I had when I was planning to talk to y'all was to list all of the intolerable situations I've been through and then tell you how wonderfully tolerant I am now. And that... probably not work either, but it probably bore you as well. But I did come up with some wonderful quotes. I mentioned Google. Here are some. Here's one from Elder Dallin H. Oakes in the essay of Balancing Truth and Tolerance. He says, tolerance for behavior is like a two-sided coin. Tolerance or respect is on one side of the coin, but truth always on the other. My wife asked me, what does that mean? I said, well, he might be doing dirty, and we can overlook it, but it's still dirty, what I'm saying? Here's one from Dalai Lama. In the practice of tolerance, our enemy is the best teacher. That's what Bill Wilson just said, isn't it? Albert Einstein. Be nice to that weird kid in school. One day he might become famous and have unlimited access to high-explosive radioactive materials in his and a security clearance next only to God. Here's some quotes on trust off of Google. Trust is like paper. Once it's crumpled, it can never be perfect again. I got to AA and I was paranoid. I mean, I grew up in a family who was, my dad was manic depressive, and don't talk about that, And so, you didn't talk about your problems, you didn't talk about your family to anybody else, it was real secretive. And so I was really stuck with that. I'm not blaming them. The stuff I was doing didn't need to be told to anybody. I mean, I was waking up in blackouts and finding out later what all this junk I'd done. I was sober about 2 years, and a friend of mine said, we were talking about, a night out at a friend's house. He said, you don't remember that. That was the night you were jumping on cars. And I didn't remember that. Not a single image in my mind. And how tolerant my friends were to think that I would do something like that and not say anything about it for 5 years, And so, I had lots of reason for people to tolerate me, no question about that. But where did I go with that? I forgot. But anyway, I read somewhere in our literature in my little research that it takes humility to trust someone, to ask for advice, and to reveal yourself. Now one of my first mentors in AA was loose-lipped. And it freaked me out, but didn't run me out. You know, I was old friends, and we're still good friends today. But, you know, I got me another sponsor. The sponsor I got lasted 27 years. He died a couple of years ago. And I'll give you an instance of trusting God. A week later, I knew I had to do something. I had to have another sponsor. I talked to that man every weekend for 27 years, or over 20 years. And so I had a few names in mind. You know, how do you get a new sponsor with, you know, 30 years? I didn't know. I just laid down. I said, God, you're going to have to sort this out. And I laid down, took a nap. The phone rang. It was one of those guys. I said, you're it. It's worked out beautifully. He got me doing an inventory, and it's probably the most in-depth inventory I've ever done, by far it was. And got me to looking at some pretty deep-seated issues, and he became area chairman, and I jumped back in the fire after 10 years of being away from area assembly, and now I'm the DCM down there, and we're down there in the area, you know, and going to back in service, and it's really a thrill, really, to be in the middle of all that again. AA is amazing. How does God empty out all the nut houses, the jails, you know, and put us all in one room and say, y'all help each other? Has he got a sense of humor or what? Impossible. Who's the leader here? Where is he? Yeah, that's what I want to know. Here's a good quote from Google. A relationship with no trust is like a cell phone with no service. All you can do is play games. Here's a real dinger. Man says, show me, and I'll trust you. God says, trust me, and I'll show you. I love that. When I was drinking, I was married, had two beautiful daughters. They left after a few years, and it got nasty. I got where I was getting DUIs all the time, and so she said, okay, she cut me off from the kids, you know, That was a big source of pain for me. I did not want to fail at being a father. And it was one of the things, besides the law, that got me in AA. And I was sober, I guess, 4 or 5 months, something like that. And I was in a meeting talking about it. And this little old lady, Pauline Woods, she's gone on now. She came to me and she said, honey, you go get those kids. You need them. And boy, was she right. I went and saw my lawyer, and I started getting regular visitation going. Never missed. And they moved across the state, and I was every other weekend. We went and got those kids. And this lasted until they were well up in their teens. I'm sure they had better things to do, but, you know, they hung with me. And I just kept trusting God and doing what was in front of me, you know. And look, when one of them got homecoming queen, I walked her across the football field. When they got married, I walked them down the aisle. When they had babies, I was there. And as sweet as that is, I got a Father's Day card the other day from my oldest. She said, Dad, I don't know who's luckier, my kids for having you as their grandpa or me for having you for my dad. I love you so much and am thankful that I have you as a dad, signed her and her husband and her kids. My youngest one posted on Facebook, so grateful for the amazing fathers in my life. They are strong, stable men who love God and love family and have proven they would sacrifice for both. Had my name and her husband's name on there. And these are kids that I would not even have known if it hadn't been for y'all. About a month ago, we rented a house up in the mountains, and there we got some in one end of the country and the other end. This is where we meet up, you know, it's halfway in between. Had a nice little holiday there. A month before that, they all came to our house and spent a week. Six grandkids. Can you believe that? And they're all great. They just love me. They think I'm great, you know. Drunk, I was nobody's friend. Let me tell you. I was mean and nasty and sarcastic, smart mouth to the end. Stab you in the back, didn't matter. You know, I was not your anybody's sweetheart, I can tell you that. I was sober a year when I met my wife, who's here, and who's getting up. I thought you were getting up to leave, don't you? Better not talk about her, I guess. I was just going to say, in trusting God, you know, it's been a wonderful 27-year marriage, and it's been great. It'd be married to another alcoholic. We go to AA and all this stuff. We did service together, traveled all over, made a lot of friends. I'm starting to see a few people here that I've known, but this is my first international. It's overwhelming. I mean, it's unbelievable. I hear we're going up to like 100,000. We're over 50 at noon yesterday, so. And they're pouring in, you know. Isn't that something? Wow. I'm really looking forward to being further amazed by y'all. Let's see if I have any more cute quotes. Let me see. Oh, here's a good one. Sometimes God's blessings are not in what he gives, but in what he takes away. Yeah. You got that, huh? Yeah. You know, like I said, my life is so better than I would have designed it. My ego wants to be, I'm a farmer, and farmers are all independent, rugged types, you know. They don't, nobody tell them what to do. They're going to do what they want to do. And, you know, sure enough, we gamble on the weather and the markets, and it's a pretty dicey ride. My ego tells me that I want to be, you know, the big dog. Well, my brother is our boss of our family farm, and so I have to be content with number two every day. And he relishes being the boss. He does. He does a great job. Let me tell you, he's brilliant. He's a great farmer. He's helped write the farm bill. I mean, he's a civic leader, and they even had his picture on billboards around there. You know, and he's a big shot. You know, and I'm so proud of him. I mean, it's my little, you know, defects of being like envious of, you know, a lot of the things I see in him that I would like to be, you know, has caused me to be catty, you know. And I think one of the keys to me tolerating others is to find my own defect, that if whatever they're doing that offends me, find me doing that to somebody else. And that nails me, you know. I had to come to that conclusion this morning or last night someone who was insulting me, you know. So I had to do my little inventory and get that done. But I did see a few ways about trust that it's already been mentioned some, and how we come into AA, trust AA, you know. I didn't trust anybody, but to finally realize that there were some principles at play here. As I said, the steps don't care who works them. And the principles are basic truths. I read one definition said principles are rules, basic rules for living. And I played football in high school, and you know, if you don't play by the rules, you know what they do? They kick you out. And that's what happened to life. I was playing life without playing by the rules. I didn't have principles. I didn't have that. And so I was getting kicked out of life. I was a chronic jailbird. Had lots of relationship problems, argue with everybody. I worked with my father and my brother, and I'd go to work, and my father would fire me about once a week, and I just kept coming back, you know. We argued and argued, and even up into sobriety, we were, you know, every day we'd get into some, my ego couldn't stand somebody telling me what to do. That was the bottom line. I was just too arrogant and proud to allow that. And my sponsor, Chick, told me, he said, "Well, just pretend it's God telling you what to do." But I did. I finally became a good son. Quit arguing with him. I didn't necessarily do everything he told me what to do, but I quit arguing, quit fighting. And when he passed away, for the first time in his life, on his deathbed, he told me he loved me. He was a tough guy. He was shooting Japs when he was 18. You know, he was a sergeant in the war and a decorated veteran. And so that was a really important relationship for me to have healed, and it was at that time. He had cancer and died. I'm trying to remember when it was, 97. He went to Florida for a second opinion, and his brother was staying with him, and they called me up. I was growing rice at the time, and his brother said, "You got to get down here. You got to be with him for this, you know." And he was waiting on tests, and so what's something I said? It rained like 4 inches at night. If you know anything about rice, that's the worst thing that can happen because it blows all your levees out. You know, but I had to get on the plane. I got on the plane. I said, "I got to go," you know, and just trusted God, got in my bag, and hit the plane. It took me 12 hours to get there because we followed that storm with that 4-inch rain all the way across the country there, and delay, you know. And I got there, and it was a healing time for us both. I went to AA. And I met a guy with many years sobriety. He was a Jesuit priest with 30 years sobriety. And he met me at a different meeting every day somewhere around there. One of those meetings, I met a guy with 50 years sobriety who got sober under Dr. Bob and his sponsorship. The relationship between me and my father was mended. He died a few months later. Trust in God. Okay, here's a good one. I was living in a little house. Right across the field was this beautiful home, big, elegant 100-year-old trees around it, tennis court in the front yard, pond in the back, lake in the front, just fabulous. And in it lived a lawyer, and this lawyer had a little dog, and the lawyer would put on a pair of white Bermuda shorts and get his little dog and walk it, you know, around out there. And I used to, I really envied that guy, you know, And there was a ditch that went from my driveway out into the field and into an underground drain. And he took a bulldozer and filled it in and flooded me out. Well, I didn't set too well with me, you know. It's back when I was drinking, you know. And I spent months stewing over that, you know. Finally, I had a backhoe on the farm. I went down there, got the backhoe, and put the ditch right back where it was, and he came down with the cops and threw a big fit. I had a terrible resentment against this guy. And after that, I'd see him walking that dog. I want to take a rifle and just, you know, and the dog too, you know. So here I am sober 18 years, something like that, and his house goes up for sale. Well, I had... My sponsor told me, if you can look a guy in the eye, you don't owe him an amend. And I took that, and it does work. But anyhow, the short of it is, we bought that house. Now, I'm the guy with the shorts and the little white dog walking around out there. Yeah. I don't know, how's our time going? Oops, time? Yeah. Okay, I think it's going to open up for, I better not give you your job, but you do your job. I'll do mine. Thank you.
Thanks, God.
Thank you.